This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The Dodd-Frank Act established the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in 2010 with the mission to protect consumers by carrying out federal consumer financial laws and also ensuring that consumers get the information they need to make the financial decisions they believe are best for themselves and their families. Here to talk about the role and operation of the CFPB are Michael Hurley and Sarah Alford, associates with Blank Rome LLP. And since it's the first Wednesday of the month, financial advisor Chris DeSimeo also joins us. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And it's good to see you, Chris.
Always good to be here.
And thank you, Sarah and Michael, for joining us this afternoon. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
And this is a relatively new federal agency, Sarah. What's its history? Where did the idea for this come from?
Well, this actually came from the philosophies of Elizabeth Warren and some other professors basically at some Ivy League universities who, and I'll let Michael kind of give you a little bit more background, but they really wanted to protect the consumer. And then, you know, with the housing market crash in 2009, they really were pushing for this. And then in 2010, the legislation went into effect and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau opened.
Yeah, as Sarah said, the CFPB, or the Bureau, came into effect with Dodd-Frank and basically created a federal agency that took from pre-existing federal agencies one of the roles that had been maybe not first on the list for those other agencies, but interacting with and informing consumers and protecting them. And they rolled all of those protections that had theretofore been under these other agencies into the CFPB and made that its primary goal. And in wrapping into it, not only is Dodd-Frank part of those acts, there were 17 other federal consumer laws that the CFPB now has the purview over to issue regulations and guidance on.
You know, Michael, Chris DeSimeo here. What happens if, say, someone gets themselves involved in a mortgage as a financial product, for example, and it turns out that it's not what they thought it was going to be, and they end up 2 or 3 years down the road with a set of nasty surprises? At that point, do they determine whether they should try to reach out to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or go to a state regulator? How do you know as a consumer what your next step is?
And this is actually Sarah's bailiwick. So
oh, good. And she's sitting right here. Good.
And so she can talk about kind of the consumer complaint process. That's a little different than like the legal issues involved, but she can go into kind of how the CFPB has been ramping up as one of its primary goals is kind of being open to the public.
Yes, the consumer complaint process through the CFPB is one of their main focuses right now. Consumers can make complaints and are encouraged to make complaints or, you know, try to get information mainly on their website, which is consumerfinance.gov, which I believe will also be available on the WVXU website. And it's really easy to submit a complaint. Actually, on every page of the website, there's a button that says submit a complaint. The consumer can go in and pick their product, whether it's a credit card or student loan issue or a mortgage issue. And it's actually pretty much easier than filling out an Amazon review or, you know, an online review. It's very easy. So you submit all the information and then the Consumer Financial Protection, the CFPB, will either handle it and notify that company themselves, or if it's something that they do not handle but it needs to go to a state regulator, they automatically forward that information on to the right regulator to handle.
Sarah, any idea how many complaints they've been getting a year since they started?
Well, they started taking credit card complaints first in the summer of 2011. They haven't released new data yet, but the last set of data was through July 2013, and they had over 175,000 complaints so far. And you can also call the CFPB And certain cities have set up 311 hotlines. I know the city of Columbus has, where if on any phone you hit 311 and you will automatically be directed to the CFPB.
Wow, interesting.
Very interesting. How large of an organization is this, Sarah, and how do they fund themselves?
Well, their funding is interesting and has been slightly controversial because they get a percentage of the the Federal Reserve budget.
Yeah, they get a demarcated percentage of the Federal Reserve budget, so they're not subject to congressional appropriation. And initially, this was done, as you can foretell. They did this to prevent Congress from trying to either starve or beef up the Bureau by using the appropriations method. So right now, their projected 2014 budget is about $500 million. So it's a very large organization.
How many people are working for CFPB, Michael? Do you know?
I think in September, they released the information. It was about 1,200. They're hiring people at a very high clip, so it might well be higher than that at this point.
And their 2014 budget includes money for about 500 new hires.
So, Sarah, once a complaint is filed, what is the process? What happens from that point on? Do they have enforcement teeth, or are they merely just somebody who steps in and says, no, you have to do this, but we can't make you do this? How does it work?
Well, there's not a direct enforcement to the companies who get complaints, but two different things happen. First of all, most consumer complaints are actually published on the website in the consumer. There's a database, so you can go on and see complaints that consumers have made about a variety of companies. But then the individual companies are notified, and they have 15 days to respond to the complaint and 60 days to resolve with the consumer. And then the consumer can follow up if they're not happy with that resolution. While there's no penalties or fines associated with that from the CFPB, the CFPB does use that data to determine who their other enforcement actions. So one of the larger banks over the summer had an enforcement action against them and ended up having to pay a lot of consumer refunds because of the number of consumer complaints that had come into the CFPB.
So in other words, if people, for example, were to complain about something that a particular credit card company, perhaps a cell phone company or something, where there's a pattern then that other regulators could then go into the CFPB's, you know, could look at the CFPB's website and detect, repeated numbers of complaints about the same thing, then that kind of triggers then more scrutiny.
Exactly.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Michael, does this agency also deal with non-banks, talking about credit cards, banks, payday lenders, mortgage servicers, that kind of thing?
And that's actually kind of one of the novel natures of the CFPB, how it was structured. Prior to the Dodd-Frank Act, different agencies had different purview of power over non-bank versus bank entities, even though a lot of them were basically selling the same products. And it was causing, for lack of a better term, kind of market disparities between the players in non-banks versus banks. So they basically dispensed with the idea of whether you're a bank or not, and looking at whether you're going to be supervised to an extent directly by the CFPB. They still have $10 billion cutoff for direct supervision of the CFPB. If your bank assets are less than $10 billion, you wouldn't be directly supervised by the CFPB. Then for non-banks, like you talked about mortgage servicers, there are what they call larger market participants. And so if you're a larger market participant in a non-bank sector, then you would be directly under the CFPB's purview. If you're not a larger one, then you would be under the state umbrella. And then there's a third category of what is essentially bad players. And if you don't fall into the direct supervision of the CFPB, if it is determined through, for example, you having a lot of consumer complaints levied against you, then the CFPB looks into it, it can basically demarcate a company as a bad player to bring it directly under its supervision and control. regulatory control. So there's quite a few different ways of the regulatory overlay, and as complicated as that just sounded, it's actually much simpler than it used to be. So for the most part, you can think about the size of the bank or the size of the non-bank in the market that it's operating in. You're likely under the direct supervision of the CFPB. If you're smaller, then you'll be under a state regulator. The most important point for a lot of the smaller players is that the CFPB has signed memorandums of understanding with 62 state regulators regarding sharing of information and helping each other out to the extent they don't have direct supervision of a certain actor. So there's a lot more federal and state cooperation now regarding consumer complaints and the consumer market.
Michael and Sarah, are there resources available at the CFPB website to keep consumers from finding themselves in trouble in the first place?
Yes, actually. On the website, it is actually pretty full of information, actually, especially for they focus a lot on students, seniors, and service members. There's specific parts of the webpage just for those, but great information about student loans and what your student loans mean, because I know a lot of people are taking out a lot of debt.
Oh, yeah.
And they have a lot of great resources and kind of easy-to-use charts that, you know, even as, you know, as attorneys, we go there and check out the resources all the time.
You know, especially – so there are resources there to help people who feel they may be victims of elder abuse, financial elder abuse, or to prevent it in the first place?
Yes. And there's the specific senior pages.
Yeah, and there's actually – they have a director – I think it might actually have just come up vacant, but they have a specific role of outreach to seniors. They have a – in their organizational structure, they have a specific department and role for outreach to seniors. I'm blanking on the name, but the man who used to be in that role was the former head of the AARP. They have a – as far as the without getting into whether or not everybody agrees with the underlying framework of the regulations, as far as the educational and outreach goes, I think everybody can agree that the CFPB is on the very cutting edge for governmental interaction. And the resources they have available on their website for calculating your student loan debt, for trying to understand different terminology in your credit card, and for ensuring that, for example, your parents aren't being taken advantage of by their financial advisor. They have a lot of great resources, educational tools, and outreach programs for those categories.
So information is a key part of what CFPB is doing. Are they requiring companies themselves to provide more information than they used to?
Yes, they are. So there were existing laws regarding what kind of disclosures companies had to make about the loans they were making. We've seen through a process called the civil investigative demand, which is essentially a regulatory subpoena. The CFPB has been very broad in its requests for documentation from companies, and they've been unabashed about saying, we have a large research and market group within the structure of the CFPB that informs our enforcement and regulation issuing divisions, and they essentially want as much possible information as they can get in formulating those enforcement and regulations. It's a lot of what Amazon and other companies are doing, Google, like the big data approach. So getting as much data as you can and then making your decisions based off of, you know, how you're crunching that data.
There was a lot of controversy when the Bureau was created. Sarah, what were some of the original objections to having this agency in place, and have any of those worries been realized since it started?
Well, one of the major concerns was the funding that we had already discussed, the fact that Congress does not have a lot of control over the CFPB, and the director of the CFPB has a lot of power. And then the other controversy was that Richard Cordray, who's the director, was appointed during a time when Congress was not in session. So there's been some issues and legal issues that they're still working out. But he has since been appointed properly through the procedures in the Senate and the House. But it's more of the amount of power that they had and, you know, what they have a the rules that they're making, especially they just implemented new qualified mortgage rules the 10th of January that took years in the making, and that they were just always kind of changing the rules for, you know, all these different entities and all, especially banks. So the banks weren't sure how to prepare to make sure they could follow all of them.
I'm looking right now, Sarah and Michael, at the consumerfinance.gov website, and it is a treasure trove of information. I just Googled CFPB.gov, and it just took me to consumerfinance.gov. But the lead banner here, four steps you can take if you think your credit or debit card data was hacked. That's the headline, safer mortgages with fewer surprises. And they're really this website just is – it makes it very easy for you to participate and to share your experiences. Is this part of a broader outreach effort by the CFPB to make itself more accessible?
Well, I think that they really consider themselves, they're for the consumer and they want to be as accessible to the consumer as possible. Besides the submitting a complaint tab, there's also a way, they say it's called the Tell Your Story tab, and you're supposed to tell them good, bad, or otherwise kind of what kind of experiences you're having with the different entities that they control. And actually, Richard Cordray uses a lot of those stories in his speeches, things that have been submitted from different consumers.
Yeah, you can follow them on Twitter and like them on Facebook as well.
Yes.
The other thing they're doing is officials of the CFPB and Cordray himself regularly talk to legal aid societies. They regularly talk to, on the industry side, banking groups and representative industries, and they've been very forthright in requesting input from all sides. One real reassuring thing for the industry players was up until the fall of this past year, as part of their supervision, where they were coming in and examining companies, they would have their enforcement attorneys, which are the people that would be, you know, suing you essentially in federal court for violating law, attend with the people doing the examinations. Understandably, the banks and non-banks that were being examined didn't get the warm and fuzzies from having people that potentially would be on the other side of a lawsuit there. They took industry feedback and are now desisting from doing that, saying that it was not constructive and kind of creating an atmosphere in which everyone was being open and honest and trying to, you know, develop the most transparent and forthright products for consumers. So they do those sorts of meetings all over the U.S., and they also do town halls all over the U.S. And like you said, you can follow them on Facebook and Twitter, and they regularly set out press reports and other means of communication. And as you can see from looking on the website, it is leaps and bounds above most federal government websites that you'll see.
Certain ones, which do not need to be named at this point.
Michael, was that one of the ideas with CFPB, that it was designed to be less cozy with the banks and the other financial companies?
That a lot of people believe that the Dodd-Frank Act only eliminated one federal agency, and that was the Office of Thrift. And a lot of people felt that the way the Office of Thrift was structured was its budget was dependent upon its members. And so they felt like that this government division was actually a captured entity by the industry players. And so it's certain people's belief that that was one of the things that led to kind of a lax regulatory structure, which then led to the housing crisis. So the idea, one of the ideas behind Elizabeth Warren's original, she also is of the belief of some microeconomists that are non-traditional microeconomists regarding a microeconomic theory that believes that you can put in a certain paradigm, so people have full choice, but they, in a certain paradigm, they can make decisions better if you put them in that decision box. So they believed that by creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and that was its sole goal, that you would, in funding it through the Federal Reserve and having a single director rather than a board, that you could prevent that industry capture.
Interesting.
So far, what's been the reaction of the financial industry to this new agency?
Mostly, well, initially before everything was figured out on the end with Cordray's appointment, trying to figure out exactly if the Bureau was going to be around for the long run, because there was heavy lobbying done in Washington to try to dilute and or abolish the agency. The agency's here for what looks like a long time. And then it became acceptance of the of it being kind of the major player in consumer the consumer product sphere, and now it's trying to work constructively within the new regulatory paradigm to make sure you're not only not violating laws, but also have a thriving business and keeping your clients, the consumers, happy. And that's been a very very quick scramble, essentially, because the regulatory promulgations of the Bureau are coming out on a monthly basis.
Sarah and Michael, both your take on this. Has the CFPB been CFPB been an effective organization so far?
I believe so. I mean, they are doing what they were supposed to do, as outlined by Dodd-Frank. They have put the new mortgage rules in place. Like I said, they just went into effect a couple weeks ago. The next step is changing some of the mortgage forms that people see. They already have those drafts out. Maybe some of their rules and regulations are not very popular with some of the industry players, but they are moving and they are, doing exactly what they said they were going to do, which is not always the case for all government entities. So,
you think they've improved the amount of information that's out there for consumers?
Oh, definitely. If even just through their website alone.
Yeah, and I would concur with Sarah in that I think you can break down their educational and outreach programs from their regulatory and enforcement programs. I don't think anybody, no matter of what political philosophy you're of, would disagree with the statement that they've been instrumental in providing educational material to consumers in a centralized location that had never before existed, and that's been very beneficial. Being such a large organization and being tasked with doing so much, you're talking about a multi-trillion dollar sphere of products that are being sold by tens of thousands of companies across the U.S., being tasked with so much as far as the regulatory and enforcement actions go, I still think it remains to be seen whether or not the application of the theory that underlies the CFPB is a success. I think it's premature to say whether or not it's had a beneficial or negative market effect.
Well, Michael and Sarah, thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Michael Hurley and Sarah Alford are associates with Blank Rome LLP. After the break, making your money work for you with a look to emerging markets. And later, in Focus on Technology, UC students are trying to come up with a smarter drone that could be used by Cincinnati firefighters. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.